Hey, hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this fantastic chat with Alex Gladstein, the Chief Strategy Officer for the Human Rights Foundation, on the franc of the Financial Community of Africa, known widely as the CFA franc or CFA, Senegal and Fighting Monetary Colonialism with Open Source Code, I want to tell you about this show's fantastic sponsors. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Ledin.io is the first digital asset lender with the transparency and security of a formal proof of reserves attestation. You can borrow against your Bitcoin if you don't want to sell, or you can use their B2X program to double your stack. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast get $10 free in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan today. If you want to see what it's all about, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix and do your own research. Secure your Bitcoin from physical disaster and a single point of failure with a CipherSafe seed storage device. CipherSafe's goal is to provide important security tools for Bitcoiners. CipherSafe focuses on securing your Bitcoin with beautiful, elegant, and practical devices. Designed, engineered, and manufactured all in-house. Machined from solid stainless steel, not stamped out. Waterproof, fireproof, and rustproof. The Cipher wheel is designed to be physically locked with a padlock and comes with a tamper evidence seal, so you can be sure of any attempts to steal your seed words. To keep your sats safe, go to ciphersafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Alex Gladstein, where we discuss French colonial history, the mechanics of the CFA system, and Bitcoin.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Alex Gladstein is Chief Strategy Officer at the Human Rights Foundation. He has also served as Vice President of Strategy for the Oslo Freedom Forum since its inception in 2009. In his work, Alex has connected hundreds of dissidents and civil society groups with business leaders, technologists, journalists, philanthropists, policymakers, and artists to promote free and open societies. Alex's writing and views on human rights and technology have appeared in media outlets across the world, including The Atlantic, BBC, CNN, Fast Company, The Guardian, The New Republic, The New York Times, Now This, NPR, Time, The Wall Street Journal, and Wired. He is the author of several notable pieces published in Bitcoin Magazine, including Bitcoin is a Trojan Horse for Freedom, Uncovering the Hidden Costs of the Petrodollar, Check Your Financial Privilege, Bitcoin is the Only Way Out, The Jack Dorsey Interview, Fighting Monetary Colonialism with Open Source Code, Bitcoin and the American Idea, Can Bitcoin Be Palestine's Currency of Freedom, Inside Cuba's Bitcoin Revolution, Finding Financial Freedom in Afghanistan, and The End of Super Imperialism, among many others. He has spoken at universities ranging from MIT to Stanford, presented at the European Parliament and US Department of State, and participated in Singularity University events around the world, where he serves as faculty and lectures on Bitcoin and the future of money. Alex Gladstein, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited that you decided to join us and really get into some of this stuff. It's really, you know, when I first heard of the Human Rights Foundation, I'd love for you to kind of give us a little background on it, because I think of some of these other organizations and, you know, maybe they're similar, maybe it's not, or just maybe it has a different story. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the organization and what the mission is.
Sure. We were founded in 2005. We have a mission of promoting individual rights around the world in authoritarian societies. We were founded by a Venezuelan and are chaired by a Russian and our president is from Lebanon, and we have a very diverse background of people. And we try to create programs and initiatives for folks to be able to support dissidents and civil society organizations in difficult political climates.
Sure. And what are some of the rights that you guys really focus on? And what are like negative rights or entitlements?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we're a civil liberties group. So we focus on things that you might see in like the US Bill of Rights or the ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. These are things like free speech and freedom to participate in your government, freedom of privacy, freedom of belief, of assembly, freedom from torture and arbitrary arrest. These are what we would call, negative rights or sort of like freedoms or liberties against a state. There are also a different group of what are known as rights, which are it's debatable. There's a huge debate over what's a human right or who gets a human right. Do robots get human rights? I mean, there's a huge debate, but basically it's broken into like negative rights, which I just described, which are like liberties, and then entitlements, which would be like the right to a house or the right to vacation or the right to healthcare, which are known as positive rights, which are things that like the government has to do for you, right? So that's kind of the background and politics of human rights.
Sure. And what happens at the Oslo Freedom Forum? What kind of activities and how does that kind of help the mission or drive the mission?
Yeah, look, we gather activists from around the world and they get to meet each other and trade notes on how they can help each other. And again, it's focused on people from these 95 plus countries around the world who live under authoritarian structures. And there's philanthropists and technologists and all kinds of people that get in there. And it's a lot of fun. It's like a big kind of brainstorming workshop for liberty.
Sure. And maybe you could tell us about Fode Diop and what happened to his family in the 90s.
Yeah. So Fode is a friend of mine from Senegal. And for the last 80 years, the people of Senegal have been using a currency called the CFA or the CFA, sort of a colonial French currency. And it is a legacy of the colonial system. And it's something that the French, put in before World War II across many of their territories in Africa. After 1960, there was a huge, obviously in the 50s and 60s, there was a huge like decolonialization all around the world, Asia, Arab world, Africa, Latin America. And the French like lost a lot of their territory. They lost Algeria. They lost Mozambique. They lost a lot of what they, previously had, Vietnam. They lost a lot of what they had colonized previously. But they wanted to hold on to like part of their colonial, treasure, essentially. And they managed to do that by giving up political freedom in exchange for financial dependence. So they continued to control the finance, economics, and currency of about 15 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, in West Africa, Central Africa, and the island of Comoros, where they would run the currency. At first, like they had total control over all of it, the decision makers of things like interest rates, the peg at which that currency would exist in relation to the actual French franc, the amount of reserves that each country, it's basically its earnings. Where would that go? Where would that live? What would that, who would get to control that? That was all controlled by Paris, all of it, for a long, long time. There were gradual reforms introduced in the 70s. And now it seems that there's some reforms being introduced sort of today, but not entirely. I mean, this is kind of crazy, but the French still control 180 plus million people through their currency. And, they've over time, between World War II and the end of the 1990s, they devalued the CFA by like more than 99% to make their like current, their exports more competitive, let's say, which of course helped the French because they were trying to like get raw minerals and materials out of those countries as cheaply as possible. But of course, what that does is it destroys the savings of the citizens. So Fode's parents were saving up for Fode to go to school, to go to university. And one day in 94, the IMF and the French decided to devalue the CFA currency by 50%. So they just lost half their money based on a decision from far away. So this is like a lot of people were really upset about this. Rightly so. I mean, I'm sure if you're listening, you'd be upset too. And, you know, that colored Fauré's life later on. So again, people were very upset. They'd been exploited, and Fauré always remembered this moment. He eventually did get to go to school. He did get to go to America. He did get to realize that things were different outside of Senegal. And over time, he realized that there would have to be some sort of change in his society where people had more power. And he had like a three-part realization. Number one, he says he realized that the CFA system was exploitation, right? Number two, he realized the smartphone would change everything and people could be their own bank on their phone. And number three, he realized after reading the white paper, the Bitcoin white paper, that about 10 years ago, he realized that Bitcoin would be like the way that people would use their bank as their phone. You know, he talks about how in his country, like if you're in Dakar, there's just like banks everywhere. There's like so many different banks. And yet people don't have financial freedom. You know, it's like there's so many rent seekers and so many middlemen, right? So he's excited about bringing financial sovereignty to people through technology. I mean, that's the story of Fauré Diop, really.
Yeah, I mean, Fauré seems to be doing a lot of things even beyond that, like even just sort of information sovereignty and the ability to connect with others online, regardless of how your government might intervene. I think he's working on sort of like mesh networking products as well, doing very fascinating things. To kind of outline how many people are, you know, affected by this, in 1960, and this is from your piece, France actually had a larger population, around 40 million people, than the 30 million inhabitants of what are now the 15 CFA nations. But today, 67 million people live in France and 180 million people live in the CFA zone. And according to UN projections, by the year 2100, France will have 74 million and the CFA nations more than 800 million, which is just sort of astounding, the dynamics of what France is sort of, the power France has retained and the ratio of people here. How political was this process? Because I think of like something like the euro and the French people got to vote whether they wanted to join the euro or not.
Barely. They got to vote. It was just very close. It was like 51-49. It was not political in any sense. Up until today, 14 of the 15 CFA countries have never had any meaningful democratization. They've always been under the rule of one strong man or another. Particularly brutal dictators, actually, who made a pact with the French that like they would use the CFA currency and allow France to exploit their nations and their resources in exchange for military backing. It's a phenomenon we see all around the world in many different places with power dynamics between a greater power and then smaller nations. The CFA country citizens had no choice in any of this. I mean, none. They resisted at the beginning. Pre-CFA, the French and other European powers introduced their own currencies, you know, that were not the local currencies. And those were resisted. And it took decades of violent coercion to force people to use the European stuff. Like, it took a long time. People did not want to do it. But they eventually got it done. And then, you know, they enforced it at the point of a gun. And whenever a politician would like push back inside the CFA network, you know, in the 60s and 70s or even 80s, like a lot of them got, some of them got straight up murdered by French troops, like Togo, for example, the leader of Togo in the early 60s. Some of them were, you know, taken out by military coups, or radicals, which conveniently the French military would kind of watch happen. You know what I mean?
Right.
So there was some, I mean, Guinea, what happened with Operation Purcell was insane.
Can you elaborate on Operation Purcell? And I think what's really interesting here is, I mean, De Gaulle's involved at this point, Charles de Gaulle, the president of France. And, you know, around this time, or maybe a little later, I mean, he's going through the same thing with the United States and trying to reclaim gold. So it's not that they don't know where they're, what the dynamics are at play here. So maybe you could elaborate on what Operation Purcell was.
Sure. I mean, the French, again, wanted to financially control these nations. And the newly elected leader of Guinea was like, no, we're going to have our own currency. So they got into a dispute and the French ended up like basically like withdrawing from the country, leaving everything in total disrepair, like basically just like ripping up everything from the ground and leaving it trashed. And then they actually to inflict damage, like in a vengeful kind of action, cruel and unusual, they printed fake units of this new currency that the Ghanaians created, and they like flooded the country with them to cause hyperinflation. This is completely insane. I mean, this is something that other countries have tried to do in the past, right? The Germans and the British during World War II tried to do it to each other, things like that. But like, this was like a colonial power doing it against a much smaller country.
Right.
I mean, just asymmetrical power imbalance, totally cruel and unusual. And that's the sort of thing that the French did to protect their, you know, their pound of flesh. It's really crazy that the system still exists.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, De Gaulle seemed to like threaten the colonies with, you know, sort of stability or chaos, whether they came on the CIFA plan or not. And what's interesting there is, I think even with Touré, he went on to become like a brutal leader at home, sort of anyway. And so it's, you know, it's interesting where, you know, maybe France is trying to, or I don't think they're trying to, but like they're making it seem like they're offering stability. But there's not necessarily a guarantee that going the opposite direction will benefit maybe the colonies. They still have to make their own choices and figure out things out for themselves. In terms of the reserves, though, in this sort of CIFA system, where are the colonies' reserves? And what are the sort of the regulations around what they can do with their treasury?
Well, and at first, all the reserves were literally and physically in Paris, like the, you know, in the system of balance of payments, when these nations would like make money through export, that balance was like settled through a central bank that the French ran in Africa, and the actual like gold holdings would be held in Paris. So eventually they allowed like some of the reserves to be held locally, and they set up like these two kind of pseudo central banks for like, basically they split the CIFA nations up into two zones. One was sort of West Africa, one was Central Africa, and then the Comoros Islands was a third. And they kind of like tried to, when it was so, they tried to like regionalize it to make it less colonialist, like, as opposed to doing everything in Paris. Eventually they decided to set up these like regional banks. And like, I believe one was in Gabon and one is in Senegal, or no, it's in Cameroon and Senegal. And I believe what they ended up doing is like loosening some of the reserve requirements. So they would like let the nations have like 30% of the reserves or something like that. But basically, again, these governments had no control over their monetary policy. And it basically led to a situation where like they encouraged like essentially the equivalent of like subsistence farming on a wide scale, in terms of like just focusing on harvesting raw minerals and exporting raw stuff, raw goods. And then like basically have to import finished goods or you know, things like electronics, cars. Like the French basically sculpted this system so that they could get cheap materials and then have a market to sell all that stuff back to make money. Also like services, the French would like be first in line for hydraulics projects, bridges, you know, public infrastructure stuff. So they basically got like an enormous amount of either free or vastly subsidized goods, ranging from uranium to timber to ore to whatever. In fact, France's entire nuclear grid that de Gaulle created, I mean, at first was powered entirely by uranium from the Sahara Desert from Niger. So it's like,
wasn't there a conflict over that as well in terms of payment? And
yeah, I mean, there certainly was over the years. And the French made no, were not hesitant to use their military to enforce what they wanted. So if there was a leader, and there was, who wanted to like sell the uranium that was their own country, located in their own country, to a higher price, the French just basically would depose that person, you know? So it got super brutal and nasty. And it was, it's just astonishing, actually, if you actually just go back and look through the history, truly astonishing. Now today, they're like, they continue to reduce the reserve requirements, but the people still have to use this. I mean, they're using a currency that's created and administered by the French. I mean, they are trying to Africanize the system in some ways, like the paper notes have like African symbols on them now and not French. But a lot of it's like cosmetic, right?
Yeah. So,
you know, a lot of people are unsatisfied with the SEPA system. And that's why, you know, an increasing number of people in those countries are turning to Bitcoin as like an alternative, as like a decolonial alternative, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Africanization of sort of the money. And then I think that bleeds into the culture, maybe with education and sort of, can you kind of talk about like, you know, maybe the World Bank will sponsor, I guess, books to be sold to the French colonies, but they, like, where are they made and who's coming up with what's the content of those books? And maybe even how important language is. I think it seems like Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, wants to sort of make French the first language of Africa.
Look, yeah, it's part of a broader mechanism of control, but I think it's like the primary one. I think that French culture has been sustained in these countries as well. I believe today there's more people who speak French in Africa than in France, of course. And I think that Macron knows that like the legacy of French culture and language is like somewhat dependent on Africa. There's this sort of bizarre, twisted historical fact. And my, you know, friends of mine who grew up in these nations, they said that like when they went to school, they would only learn about like French inventions and history, and they didn't learn a lot about English stuff or the American stuff or, you know, Asian stuff. It was, you know, it's like a glorification of your master, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, look, it's a cruel system in a lot of ways, and again, people are protesting peacefully against it by choosing a different kind of money.
Is this economic apartheid?
I mean, what does that term mean? It's unclear. I would argue that, yeah, certainly you could describe it as such. I think monetary colonialism is probably more accurate, but if you compare the rights of the French citizens versus the rights of the CFA citizens, yes, then it starts to resemble apartheid. It's just they're not like living in the same country, so I'm not sure the metaphor makes sense. But it's more like a colonial kind of relationship, right? Where you have the metropole and you have the dependency countries, territories.
Right. And do you think like, I mean, how does this affect things like natural resources? I mean, we mentioned a little bit about right of first refusal, but and like, is how is this similar to petrodollar recycling?
Well, petrodollar recycling refers to the phenomenon of how the Arab states, Saudi Arabia and the OPEC nations in the early to mid 1970s, as a result of increasing the price of oil, generated massive revenues and didn't know what to do with them. So the United States government convinced them to basically like take those earned dollars, those petrodollars, and recycle them back into America through US securities, through debt. So, you know, it's not exactly the same, but it is in a way, because, you know, like the nations in the CFA system basically had to, with their earnings, they have to buy, you know, French monetary instruments. Right. So it's not exactly the same phenomenon, but it's similar. Yeah, similar.
Yeah, and I think they have to pay France to like 45 million euros a year for the notes and the coins.
Yeah, I mean, look, there would be France has subsisted on interest on the reserves from this much larger group of people. Everything that they've earned, France has gotten to take the interest and stuff from, and all that. It's just a ridiculous amount of financial exploitation, basically.
Yeah. The, I'm kind of curious what your thinking was as you met different activists from Africa. I mean, maybe we'll get into Farida's story, but you know, as you were unpeeling this, was it sort of mind blowing, or were you kind of did you kind of know the framework of the CIFA system as you were getting into this and how bad it was? And I as we turn maybe to Farida's story, like what happened with, you know, I'm kind of curious maybe what happened with Togo, because that seems like a very clear example of France kind of exerting control and not going towards, you know, sort of human rights or democracy with what happened in Togo.
Well, again, there's this relationship between the administrators of the CIFA system and the French government. They would support these dictators. And again, virtually all these countries remain authoritarian. And the people, again, have no recourse to change. It's not like they can like vote for a new ruler who's going to like not use the CIFA, you know?
Right.
But the people are in a tricky situation, because like, what if they do get independence? I mean, what are the chances that the new ruler is going to be like is going to be a responsible administrator of a monetary policy? Like, yeah. I mean, slim. So that's why I think Bitcoin is such an important kind of alternative for them.
Sure. With like looking at Farida's story, and I mean, her family's been involved in human rights and the struggle for human rights for a long time. But she kind of had an awakening with what happened to, I think, Sylvanus Olympio. Mm-hmm. And sort of maybe you could outline what happened there and sort of what he was trying to do and France's reaction to that.
Well, he wanted to establish a Togolese central bank and a Togolese currency. And the French did not want that. They wanted to continue to be able to exploit this nation's resources and its labor. So they assassinated him with a team of French soldiers. And they got this guy Nisimbe and his family to rule Togo ever since. And they've been loyal servants of the CIFA system.
Right. And that assassination happened like 2 days before.
Yeah, it happened a few days before they were supposed to go independent financially. Like it was like, you know, a matter of 2 weeks or something like that. Maybe even right. Less. Maybe it was a few days, but it was very short. Yeah.
And sort of the crucible, the foundation of this system, did this have sort of like Germanic roots or sort of roots in sort of France being overtaken by Germany and then sort of replicating this system?
Yeah, in the roots of the system were, you know, some people have said that they were, you know, inspired even by what the Germans had created under the Nazi government. That's at least what a friend of mine told me. But I mean, it's clear that like different colonial powers had different monetary strategies. And the idea of the CIFA was created by France, you know, maybe inspired by the Germans, but the idea was like, let's unite all of our territories under one currency. It just made things easier for them, you know?
Right. I'm kind of curious about the operational accounts, you know, so the French, the colonies, the 15 nations, or not colonies anymore, but the 15 CIFA nations have their treasuries in France or in the central banks that are regional central banks that are controlled by France. And does that give sort of the French authorities the ability to spy on the spending habits or influential people in the colonies because they could see what happens in the operation accounts?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously. The board of people who controlled the banking, it's not like they were from like Senegal or Togo or Benin or whatever. They're French, so they were able to basically have like total surveillance over the monetary situations of these countries, and whenever the countries didn't deliver, they wanted to squeeze them for more, you know, and they would devalue the currency.
So how do you see, or where do you see Bitcoin fitting into this? Do you think that Bitcoin could kind of play out the way we're seeing things kind of start in El Salvador, in Africa, Do you think that this could be sort of a decolonization, a tool that can help decolonize Africa?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people can find their financial freedom. I mean, what is colonialism? It's controlled by a foreign power, right? I mean, so Bitcoin allows you to be your own bank and opt into a system that no foreign power controls. And that's why I think people like Farida Naburema and others call Bitcoin a decolonial currency.
Right. And how much of Africa's sort of economy is around remittances, especially in the CIFA nations?
So the percentage of GDP from remittances ranges, but in some of these countries, you know, it can be 5, 6, 7, 8%. In some countries, it's 10 to 15 to 20%. So it can be quite high. And again, middlemen take cut from all those remittances coming in from Togolese in France and other countries.
Right.
And that will often accrue back to the French state. Right. So rather than like when you send 100 euros now to your family in Togo from France, like the French business state kind of complex extracts wealth from that payment. You don't need to do that anymore. You can operate in a peer-to-peer sense where you're not dealing with that machine. You're, right. You know, in a parallel structure. I think that's quite important.
Are any of these nations doing better now economically than they were 30 or 40 years ago? Have any of them prospered on this system, the CIFA system? Would any of them be an example we could point to as, yeah, it's working out for them, that their GDP or their GDP per capita is higher now?
I mean, you know, living standards are up a little bit everywhere, you know, because of obvious trends in technology and medicine and things like that. But
right.
As far as like real wages and stuff, I mean, nah. I mean, these countries are in some cases doing just as badly as they were in the 70s. I mean, there's in a lot of these countries. I mean, look, they remain, I think, like something like close to 4 or 5 of the world's poorest 15 countries are in this CIFA zone. It's devastating. I mean, these countries have been sort of kept poor. Like they might be growing at a small rate, but it's like compared to the rate the French state has grown, like it's differentially very different, you know?
Right. And what is going on maybe in Mali and Chad right now?
I mean, there are like conflicts with extremist forces, and there's been coups, and you know, in the Chad case, the French government has tried to support a particular dictator, and in the Mali case, the French government was like, you guys don't want to support our system, fine, you can fight the terrorists, and they like basically allowed them to take over. So they kind of use, even to this day, they use loyalty to the CIFA system, you know, is very important in their eyes from a foreign policy.
Right. How do you deal with sort of the evolution of these instances or what's happening around the world? How does it weigh on you? Do you ever get impatient, you know, in terms of you see some of the tools available and the opportunities, but things don't always move quickly. And you know, things don't always, in the short term, things could be really serious and, you know.
Yeah, we just got to work block by block. You know, it's like person by person, brick by brick, we'll get to the right, we're moving in the right direction. Like people have an alternative. Like they can be financially free. They can connect with each other. They can take the walls down. It's just a matter of education. And, you know, we're going to do our part at the Human Rights Foundation to try and help. So we've got some stuff we're going to be funding in the next few months in the CFA zone. Actually, we just funded some work in Senegal. We're going to fund some work elsewhere. So we're doing what we can.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are doing a lot. I know you guys announced you guys in Q3 gifted 375 million Satoshis from the Bitcoin Development Fund to 10 projects spanning the globe. And this round focused on Bitcoin privacy and dev education in emerging markets and improving user onboarding experience and continued core development. But what can people like me or us at home do to help or get involved if we just don't want to sit on the sidelines? You know, maybe we're curious about what's going on around the world. We want to help. We want to see things get better. What are things people can do?
Yeah, I think that spreading awareness and education about Bitcoin is helpful. I think that spreading knowledge about the CIFA system is helpful. I mean, if we want to start from, you know, ground zero or square one, would be talking about the CIFA system, helping people understand that this European power still controls these nations and these people. And then from there, we can discuss alternatives. A lot of people aren't going to support Bitcoin as an alternative. That's fine. That they should have something they can do. Maybe that's a general advocacy, educational thing. Great. I personally think that Bitcoin's the most effective way to help people because it actually can give them meaningful freedom. It's not just like virtue signaling.
Right. What I found so confounding about this is like France doesn't even have its own money anymore. I mean, it's in the euro system, and yet they still control the money, the currency, and what seems like a lot of the wealth of these 15 CIFA nations. And what is going on now with the ECO? And sort of, I think that's sort of an African initiative that has France sort of co-opted that. Where is that going? Is anyone sort of coming to that project?
Sure.
That-
I mean, the ECO is like ECOWAS is a West African trade zone that includes Nigeria and some other larger countries like Ghana that are not a French colonial kind of legacy. And the goal was that they would create their currency called the ECO. And the French government basically tried to undermine it and take control of it. And it sounds like there will still be an ECO, but it's really going to be the larger countries like Ghana and Nigeria that have stronger economies. They were like, we're not joining that. No way. So, you know, France kind of like submarined the process. And if anything, the ECO just looks like it'll be like a rebrand of the CIFA for the West African CIFA nations, for like the seven of them that are in West Africa. There's still going to be seven other ones in Central Africa that are not affected by this at all. And the Comoros as well.
Right. My final question is around, I mean, we've seen politically and even just militarily, France, they've kind of played their cards based on who's going to support them and the CIFA system. What do you make of even last year? I think there were five African leaders that passed away or died last year. And it just seems like a tremendous amount of transition, and it seems odd. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, look, what France is trying to do today is cover up a fake reform. Like they again, all their actions in the region today are not enough. Like it's slow, gradual, and they continue to control, basically. So I would just say that there's nothing on the roadmap for financial freedom for these people. Nothing. Mm. There's just nothing out there. So hence, again, why I think Bitcoin is important.
Yeah, I could see that. Well, I really appreciate, you know, the time that we've gotten to spend. The CIFA system really kind of, it seems like a mini version of the dollar system. And that's why I thought it was so interesting to kind of dig into. And it just sort of illuminates, I think, what's happening around the world with different currencies, but in a very smaller framework. But still, it's almost 1 billion people that will be affected by this in 80 years or so. So the impact is huge. And just the legacy of the system just blows my mind. So yeah, I really appreciate you sort of illuminating and elaborating on it. Please let people know everywhere they could find you and sort of the initiatives that HRF takes on and maybe where HRF can be found. So people can get involved and kind of follow up and get more information.
You can follow me on Twitter at Gladstein, or you can follow the Human Rights Foundation at HRF.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate this.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This episode was brought to you by CipherSafe and Ledin. If you enjoy the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, please tell your friends and family about the show. And I also ask that you write a 5-star review on your podcast platform. That is really the best couple of ways to help the show gain awareness, grow, and become sustainable. And thank you for listening. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused. This is Cedric. Peace.